תביא לשתיקות שלך, מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך, מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך. אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Byman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And yesterday there was a high-level briefing of a number of reporters in Israel where military officials talked about how the next war with Hezbollah could be so much worse than the 2006 Lebanese war, where 4,000 rockets were fired onto Israel, killing 40 civilians. This time around, they're talking about 60,000 to 100,000 rockets with longer ranges, greater accuracy, and much bigger warheads. And this has been described as a whole new ball game, according to the official that briefed to the reporters. What's going on in Israel? Are the public being prepared for another war with Hezbollah?
The public is being prepared in a general sense. Since the very, very bloody and destructive 2006 war, the border between Lebanon and Israel has been surprisingly quiet, perhaps the quietest it's been in decades. And as a result, there's a sense among the Israeli public that this problem is diminished. And I think given the turmoil in Syria and the turmoil in Lebanon, the Israeli government wants to make sure the public is not only vigilant, but is not getting a false sense of security.
Well, what about this Iron Dome weapon system? 60 Minutes did a piece making it sound like it was the perfect weapon system. And of course, we've had a lot of skepticism over the years about the anti-ballistic missile system, and we spent zillions on trying to intercept, you know, as they say, to hit a bullet with a bullet. It's not technically not a very easy thing to accomplish. What's your understanding on Iron Dome? Because apparently, if there is an attack from Hezbollah with up to 100,000 rockets raining down on Israel, apparently Iron Dome is hardly sufficient, even if it works as well as, say, the 60 Minutes piece indicated.
That's right. Iron Dome can certainly handle, at least to some degree, limited or isolated attacks, but you can't overwhelm the system. The problem for Hezbollah is that if it tries to do massive attacks, that requires a lot of time. And if they're fighting Israel, if Israel's air force is flying over Lebanon, if Israel's artillery itself is ready, it's unclear if Hezbollah will have lots of time to prepare attacks and to launch them continually. So Iron Dome may prove effective or at least diminish some of the impact of Hezbollah, but certainly Israelis should not count on it.
So in the context of what's going on next door, where you have not right next door, but just to the north of Lebanon, you have a country literally being torn apart and bleeding terribly, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. And there have been a number of Israeli strikes against Hezbollah convoys, allegedly bringing in sophisticated weaponry. And there was a more recent attack on July the 5th that got little to no publicity, and the only publicity it got was here in the United States, which apparently upset a lot of people in Israel. They don't want to put their signature on these strikes, and this was apparently in the port of Latakia, where a bunch of advanced anti-ship missiles were destroyed, but apparently not all of them. So what is the game that Israel is playing here? Obviously, it would seem to me that if they were to turn the Syrian civil war into an Arab-Israeli war, that would be a gift to Assad, would it not?
Certainly, and Israel is trying to avoid it. Part of the reason for the relative silence on the Israeli side is, even as they're doing strikes, they don't want to become the news story. For Israel, what they're concerned about is that the chaos of war will lead weapons to go from Syria to Hezbollah, including chemical weapons and more advanced surface-to-air missiles, for example. And they're also concerned that Iran is going to step up transfers. So they're trying to stop these, but at the same time, stay out of the headlines.
So what do you make of this theory that floated by some analysts that the strategy, if indeed we do have a strategy, there seems to, always seems to have been a lot of ambivalence on the part of the West about what to do in Syria, you know, in contrast to the Iranians and the Russians who seem to be, and Hezbollah, who seem to be quite focused and know exactly what they want and are supporting Assad to the hilt. There's obviously been some ambivalence on the Western side, but I don't know that that's a strategy, which is, you know, to have them bleed each other to the point of exhaustion, and then maybe there's some kind of peace deal can be made. But this other strategy that was suggested the other day was that there could be an attempt to turn Syria into Iran's Vietnam. In other words, they get sucked in with men, materiel, and particularly with money, because my understanding is that the Syrian economy is just flat broke, and without subsidies from Iran, Assad would have gone under a while back. So what do you make of that theory?
The Syrian conflict has been a real problem for Iran, and I would say so in two ways. First, the Syrian conflict has really hurt Iran's credibility in the broader Muslim world. Iran for years had played up the idea that it was standing up to the United States, it was standing up to Israel, and now it's seen as backing a almost genocidal government that's slaughtering Sunni Muslims, so it's really damaged Iran's reputation. Also, Iran is propping up Syria financially, as you mentioned, and Iran itself is under huge financial strain. The sanctions that the Obama administration has orchestrated are really biting deep. So Iran doesn't have much money to spare, and Syria needs a lot. The Vietnam analogy doesn't quite work in terms of casualties, because while Iran does have some forces in Syria, it's not huge numbers. It's not comparable in any way to U.S. deployments in Vietnam or later on in Iraq. But this is a conflict that is causing problems for Iran, even though Tehran sees it as vital to shore up an ally.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Byman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumph and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. So a lot of analysts have told me that the 2006 war, as far as the Israeli generals are concerned, it's not over. I know there was a lot of bitterness after that war. There were recriminations. There was an investigation. I believe it didn't lead to the downfall of Prime Minister Olmert, didn't it?
It certainly contributed. It was mainly personal corruption, but the war was a blow to his prestige and his handling of Israel in general.
So the question is there a constituency in the Israeli military that would like to have a second crack at Hezbollah?
There's a constituency in the Israeli military that sees Hezbollah as an arm of Iran, and Israel is concerned, even obsessed to some degree, over the Iranian threat. I think most Israeli military leaders have a fairly healthy respect for Hezbollah and aren't particularly eager to have another round. It's more a question of whether they see it as inevitable. And in particular, when you think of the confrontation over Iran's nuclear program, if the U.S. strikes, if Israel strikes, there's an expectation that Hezbollah, on behalf of Iran, will strike Israel. So the question then becomes, if we're going to go down this road, would Israel strike Hezbollah first in the hope of preempting and avoiding a lot of the damage Hezbollah would otherwise do?
So if then an attack on Hezbollah is a precursor to any attack on Iran, because Hezbollah is Iran's means to retaliate, how do you rate the situation vis-a-vis Iran and Israel at the moment? I mean, there's been lots and lots of rumors of war, talks of war for the longest time now. There is a new Iranian leader. What's your sense then of where things stand?
There have been talk of war for really over 5 years now, and everyone seems to say that, you know, this year will be decisive. So it's always unclear to me, you know, exactly when we're going to see a firm decision one way or another. But certainly Israel wants to keep this option open, and it's hoping that at least the threat of this option will make the United States be more successful in its economic and diplomatic campaign at the very least. But I think some people believe Israel's window has really passed, that the best time for Israel to have done this was a year or two ago, and that it'll be less effective than it would be if it did so today. But this is something that is a political as well as strategic question. the Prime Minister of Israel has campaigned on the idea that he will not let Iran go nuclear. And so as Iran gets closer and closer to this, this raises the question of his own credibility as well as a threat to Israel.
So what is going on then with these peace talks? Are they in any way a response to the broader tensions in the neighborhood, the growing sectarian split within Islam between Shia and Sunnism, which is manifested in the proxy war in Syria? Iraq is extremely fragile, and that domino could fall or be ignited by the war next door in Iran. And there's been some major shifts in the political alliances now with the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. My understanding is that Hamas is quite vulnerable now, and the Egyptians have just closed the border with Gaza, and they're going to seal that up. So is there a possibility that the outside shifts in the geopolitical landscape are prompting the Israelis and the Palestinian authorities to try and get serious? Or?
The safe answer is no. We all hope that so. But in general, the insecurity and the uncertainty of the external environment, I think, has made both sides more cautious. That on the Palestinian side, there's a sense that they're not sure they'll have backing from neighboring Arab states, which they've always seen as essential. And there's a real division between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority that shows no sign of being bridged. On the Israeli side, I think they're concerned that any government they make peace with in the West Bank might disappear tomorrow. They're afraid that the instability in Syria, the instability elsewhere in the region, could spread to a new Palestinian state. So they're very concerned that their negotiating partner is politically weak. And as a result, I think they'll move very slowly if they can.
Well, some of the reports, though, about Gaza and about Hamas following the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was obviously a major sponsor. Hamas was originally sprung out of the Muslim Brotherhood. The reports indicate that the people in Gaza are obviously absolutely fed up, and they've been living under hideous conditions for the longest time, and they're not happy with this very rigid religious government. I mean, the idea of the Israelis making a peace with the Palestinians is absurd on the surface, isn't it? Because which Palestinians are we talking about here? So is there any chance that you'll end up with a real Palestinian side to talk to? In other words, a united Palestinian side?
In the near term, there seems to be a little chance. As you mentioned, Hamas's loss of the Muslim Brotherhood government is seen as a huge blow. And as a result, the Abbas faction in the West Bank sees little need to make a deal. That now that their ascendant, now that their allies are winning elsewhere, why bother to make a deal and let Hamas in the door, if you would? And as a result, the Palestinians don't speak with one voice. And it's so easy for Hamas to criticize any concessions, let alone the big ones that would be necessary for peace. And in addition, if Hamas starts to launch rocket attacks on Israel or otherwise stirs the pot, it's going to be very hard to have negotiations on both the Israeli and on the moderate Palestinian side.
So what are these talks about then? Is this about the process as opposed to peace itself?
Well, there's always hope that this will be talks about peace itself. As you could tell, I'm skeptical of this, but I do think it's worth trying. The odds might be very low, but maybe you can get something moving. Maybe the external environment will shift for the better. Maybe there'll be changes politically among the Palestinians or among the Israelis that make the governments more favorable to peace talks. To me, it's worth trying, even though there's a good chance it's going to fail.
So we started out talking about the briefing that took place yesterday by senior military officials and briefing the foreign press and the local press in Israel about the possibility of Hezbollah raining down up to 100,000 much longer range, more accurate, and with larger warheads, missiles than were rained down on Israel, some 4,000 back in 2006. And we recall that that was pretty traumatic. So you have some sort of preparation, both, I guess, psychological and physical in terms of bomb shelters. But it's still, as far as I know, I mean, at least one-third of the population doesn't have bomb shelters. So how serious is this briefing yesterday, do you think, in terms of preparing the Israeli public for something?
I think it's certainly serious in the sense that the Israeli government's threat perception is that things are going to get worse, not better, that Lebanon, which has been calm for a while, is becoming less stable, that Hezbollah, which has been deterred by Israel for a while, may be becoming bolder, that the Syrian border in particular and the Golan, there may be jihadists or others across the border that are going to open up a new front against Israel. So to me, this is a reaction against the uncertainty and the genuine fear in Israeli strategic circles, and they want to make sure the public is prepared for what might come down the road.
Well, just in closing, it does seem that the other border in the south, the border with Egypt, is the one where there is activity that you haven't had. You haven't had military clashes on that border since Camp David, and now they're starting to happen. And Israel just closed its airport at Eilat in the Sinai because of undisclosed security assessments. My understanding is that the Sinai itself is becoming something of a no-man's land, that there are tremendous infiltration of jihadis coming in there from all around the world, and it's a security vacuum. And as long as the Egyptian military are tied up with the street protests and with this unstable political situation in Egypt, one wonders whether or not they're going to be able to deal with this situation. So is it possible that here we are having a discussion about Israel perhaps preparing for a war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and yet, you know, you've got this new front opening up in the south?
Israelis are very concerned about instability in the Sinai. As you mentioned, this has gone from a non-problem to a minor problem to a major problem. We've seen cross-border attacks on Israel. We've seen attacks on the pipeline going to and from Egypt and Israel. And there's concern that weapons from Libya have spread to the Sinai, perhaps including surface-to-air missiles. So Israelis are very concerned about this. Their hope is that, especially with a military-led government in Egypt now, that there'll be a greater effort on the Egyptian part to go after the rebels in the Sinai. Israelis are not eager to do their own operations there. They're afraid that it will only make things worse. So the belief is that by better defenses, by encouraging the government of Egypt, and in part by just sucking it up, Israel can weather that storm.
Well, Daniel Byman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Byman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumph and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Chicago for an update on the ALEC conference.